Jerry, I'm going to tie something you said earlier back into a new segment of the show that I'd like to start called Joe's Conspiracy Corner. And see, now it doesn't get a laugh from you guys. This is the problem. Can you edit in the laughs,
throw in the studio
please?
Laughter. Yeah,
exactly. That'd be great. I really hope I hear studio laughter on this show. That'd be amazing. Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from nearly half a century of combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks and Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group. Listen live and join us in the chat at commandcontrolpower.com on the first Tuesday of every month. We also offer a weekly email newsletter, which includes show notes for each episode. Learn more at commandcontrolpower.com. And thanks for listening.
This episode of Command Control Power is sponsored by Watchman Monitoring. Watchman Monitoring is your gateway to managed services.
Welcome to Command Control Power. We are live. So, Sam, I have some follow-up from something you brought up on one of the previous shows about the 27-inch iMac with the loose, hinge on the foot. It kind of the floppy 27-inch iMac.
Yeah.
So you had recommended the Mac hack, which is something that I think we've I've recommended to clients as well. We have some follow-up from my very own consultant here at CIMAC, CJ. He mentioned the repair on that is not quite as challenging as I said it was, although it's still pretty challenging. You do have to remove every single component in the iMac. So you don't actually do the back housing. You don't replace the back housing, but you do have to remove every component before you repair the actual hinge. It's this plastic spring of some sort.
Removing all that sounds challenging enough.
Exactly. It's bad enough as it is. So it's still pretty rough. Now, that said, CJ also offered another bit of wisdom, which I think could be really useful to anybody who's gone through this. If you've actually gotten the repair done, thinking, this is an out-of-pocket expense, Apple will actually reimburse a client for the cost of that repair retroactively. So they can call Apple and negotiate a discount, or I should say a refund, for the price of whatever repair was done. And I guess it's not something that's like a repair extension program. It's not official. I don't think there's an Apple page about it, but it's one of these kind of unlisted repair extension programs that, the Apple store will know about, and Apple Care, I guess, will know about. So if you've paid for that out of pocket, should call Apple.
And does it need to be done by a service center?
That I'm not sure about. That's a good question. I mean, I wonder if just any receipt, from somebody halfway reputable would suffice. That I'm not sure about, though.
They'll reimburse you after the fact with something as simple as a receipt. That's interesting.
Right. And I guess apparently, they will do it in the store. If you haven't had this done yet and you're having this issue, bring it to the Apple store and they'll do it for free. And I think you and I touched on that. We thought that, we speculated that was probably possible. Or maybe, I think, right. Did you mention that you had researched that and it...
Yeah, that's what I thought was the case, but I didn't know about this that you're talking about now.
Right. So that was an unofficial thing that now we have some confirmation of, and the retroactive part I thought was really interesting that they'll actually cover it going back.
I think the hinge was $25.
The MacHack.com.
I'm okay. It'll cost me more in my hourly rate to call Apple and deal with that.
Well, getting Apple to pay for something called the MacHack probably is going to be a fight as well. So, yeah. So I have some more follow-up on a calculator. This is really important. I mentioned the TI something calculator, Texas Instruments. It was actually the TI-83. Just wanted to clarify that. That's what we used in school, the TI-83 calculator that you could program, and it had a little IR thing, I think, or maybe a little, not eighth inch, but Jerry, what's the smaller headphone connector than eighth inch? It's like a 16th inch or something. But the calculator actually had this port, and you could plug in another calculator into it, and you could actually transfer data between the two, transfer programs and things. It was pretty freaking cool to have that. Nowadays, it's silly because the iPhone does, all that and a little bit more. But this was a calculator that you could actually use as a little handheld computer. It was pretty neat.
Was that one also solar powered, Joe?
No, that one wasn't. It was just too sophisticated. I think it had three or four AAA batteries or AA maybe. So yeah, that was a trip. I do probably still have one somewhere around here though.
So we have some follow-up on a iMac that we talked about two shows ago called the Jiggler. Those of you who are regular listeners will remember that the only way I could get this new iMac to fully encrypt was to keep it alive and download this Jiggler program, which basically moved the mouse every 5 minutes to keep the Mac from not throttling down and to keep the encryption going. Well, I'm sad to say that the Jiggler iMac definitely gave up the ghost, and we got a call probably about a week later from the client saying there's still something wrong. So we came on site. Apple apps would launch fine, so you could launch something like Numbers or Pages or Keynote, and those apps would launch almost immediately. But if we were downloading or launching Microsoft Office from the dock, Word or Excel, they would bounce and bounce and bounce and bounce and bounce, and finally they would open. And again, this was a Fusion drive. So I marched it down on the client's request to the Apple store. They looked at it, you know, and they were saying, look, it passed all our tests. They have a program called Files. Genius said, did you run Files? Because he was thinking, you know, us being Apple consultants, we had access to some of their diagnostic utilities. Files evidently checks the SSD and also the spinning drive, because again, this was a Fusion iMac and it all performed fine and all passed all the tests. But he saw the same thing that we did, where, you know, you would launch Microsoft Office. And he said, well, could it be Office? I said, well, it could, but, you know, I was hoping you could do more for us. So initially they were going to keep it. And then through a lucky course of events, they swapped out the iMac. So we were very thankful for that. So we brought the iMac back on site, fully updated the iMac to 10.13.2. I ran a migration, and then the iMac rebooted, and it ran 10.13.3. And when it did that, the client was presented with a message that said, hi, Sierra, the path system installation packages osinstall.mpkg appears to be missing or damaged. And if you do a Google search on this, there's threads and threads of people having this problem with dating back all the way. And what this is usually a bad installer. So we couldn't boot back into the Mac desktop. So this is the brand new iMac that I wanted to get on High Sierra 10.13.3. So the only thing we could do, or the only thing I could do, was boot off of the recovery partition and download a brand new installation of High Sierra from Apple, and then the Mac booted fine. So that was all well and good. Met with the client actually as early as today in the course of getting this Mac fully set up. It's a medical office, so one of our goals is to have all the workstations fully encrypted. So now this is the brand new child in the family, and this is the last one we need to encrypt. And I'm assuming now this is, you know, our brand new iMac and everything's fine. I go to encrypt the drive, go to the security and just say turn on File Vault. Encryption password, of course, we generated a key and I recorded that information. As soon as it went to reboot and turn on File Vault encryption, we got a message that popped up saying boot file not written. And so it couldn't launch File Vault. And so that was really odd. So I booted off the recovery partition, and when I booted off the recovery partition, it run disk utility and run repair. It said it couldn't unmount the volume. So the only way I could check the actual hard drive was to boot from internet recovery. I booted from internet recovery. I was able to run disk utility and run repair. The drive was fine. Went back, booted into the desktop, and tried to launch File Vault encryption again. Same issue. Boot file not written. So I was really stumped, and I told the client, we'll work on encrypting this volume, you know, in the next several weeks, and we'll get back to you on this, and I'll do a little bit more research. So I went back to the office, and thank goodness for Slack, and thank goodness for the generosity of a lot of very, very smart and wonderful people that are out there on the internet. And who else do you go to for File Vault problems? Who's the master? Who's the capo de capo of File Vault?
Der Flounder, otherwise known as Rich Troughton.
Absolutely. Had a conversation, a brief one with Rich. He was very nice. He's always generous with his time and just a lovely, lovely guy. We had him on the show a couple of years back. We need to have him on again because he's a wonderful resource for all us Apple techs. He said, it's a Fusion drive, right? And I said, yeah, absolutely. He said, well, you know, just send me the report on the core storage, the listing of the core storage volumes, shot it over to him. And he said, it looks fine. I have no idea. And I said, well, if this was your iMac, what would you do? And he said, the only way you can fix it from here is make sure you got a couple good backups, start from internet recovery, reformat the entire drive, and restore it. You know, we're seeing just lots of weird stuff. not necessarily High Sierra. I was talking a couple weeks ago how, you know, everybody wants to point the finger at High Sierra, how it's kind of problematic. But I think we've got a couple things going on here. I think we've got IMAX and Fusion Drives and High Sierra, and you just put that into the mix and you get not necessarily successful results all the time.
Well, I'm not a fan of Fusion Drives in general just because of some past experiences, but from start to finish, Jerry, that was a whole lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
Luckily, like you said, they were able to replace the iMac, and then you have these chain of events afterwards seem to be software related. Even Sumpt Rich, which is beyond me. That's interesting. Man, that's a series of unfortunate events if I've ever heard of them.
Rich was just looking for a Disk Util CS list. He looked at that. He said everything looks normal. Who knows what's going on with this brand new iMac out of the box, second one.
I agree with you, Sam, though. I'm not a big fan of Fusion Drives. I've really started avoiding them. I mean, not started. I've been doing this for a while. But even when clients need the space, they're kind of like above a terabyte. I know the 2 terabyte SSD is expensive, but I just think it's a good investment when you're talking about having a computer for 3 to 5 years, say. You know, it is expensive, but if you look at that price over the course of that amount of time, and potentially much less aggravation, much better speed, I think it's a good value proposition. I really avoid them. So I don't know what your policy is on that, you know, both you guys, but you know, a client has to sort of talk me into it, and it's not without like reservations if they want to go with that.
No, that's absolutely true, Joe, but it's such a hard sell for them to upgrade to the SSD. It really is, especially for a business. And, you know, that's what these Fusion Drives were intended for. Rich did say at the very end of our conversation, he's not a fan of Fusion Drive. Yeah, exactly. If you don't like Fusion Drive, send your cards to Joe Saponari, please.
You know, it's worth mentioning, you know, Rich's opinion, because he's a guy who has a lot of experience at a low level with the file system in general, you know, and how it interacts certainly with File Vault. So Fusion Drive, yeah. I mean, if you know, I take his word for it as well, and it certainly matches my experience. If you make the case, it may result in more downtime. You know, that factors into the value proposition. You know, if you make the case that, you know, you may have to pay me to come and intervene in issues that may crop up, that also affects the value proposition. But it's a really tough sell, as you mentioned, because it's, you never want to, I mean, first of all, you don't want to base it on fear, uncertainty, and doubt. That's one. But it's, you also don't want to sort of like say the product is bad, they should expect problems. And so it's a really fine line. And I totally agree, it's a tough sell. I just have gotten more frank with clients in that situation where, because then the other thing that comes up is it's a negotiation. And then they're saying, well, just put stuff on an external drive. And I'm not a fan of doing that either. So if it came down to it, I suppose I might be talked into a Fusion Drive rather than having half your stuff on this SSD internally and half of it on an external that's going to get unplugged randomly and whatnot.
I push away from the Fusion Drives as well, as you just mentioned, so I don't need to rehash it. But if you get pushback, there's not a whole lot you can do because it's their money being spent. Ultimately, you can give them the good advice, but they make the decision.
So there's a new segment to the show. It's called Joe's Conspiracy Corner. And Jerry, I believe you have a conspiracy. Maybe you don't know it yet. That you'd like to add to Joe's Conspiracy Corner. This is something you mentioned earlier about macOS could not be installed in your computer. This happened with your Fusion Drive issue.
By the way, Oliver Stone has been in touch with us and he wants to make a movie of this, but please continue with the conspiracy.
So the issue is that this happened to multiple computers like right around the same time. So I'm not sure why that was. I think that basically some small percentage of computers that attempt to install either 10.13.3 or some update, maybe 10.13 in general, have this issue. And for whatever reason, I had like 3 clients in a row in rapid succession. I had like an email come in, and then I had 2 phone calls about it. And I reached out to you guys, and I think at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think either of you guys had actually seen this issue right at that early stage when I saw it like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, and I think you saw it earlier than I did. Yeah,
and then I think you encountered it, and I think you've both encountered it now several times. Is that right?
No, just Jerry. I remember him talking about it after the fact.
Interesting. So, you know, my theory is just that there's updates that happen automatically, and I don't know exactly which ones or why. It's certainly a weird message because it says macOS could not be installed in your computer, and it's basically like the macOS installer app that launches after the initial prep when you're just trying to upgrade to 10.13, for example, from 10.12. It does its little sort of pre-flight stuff. It reboots to like an installation partition, I think. and it tries to install the OS. Normally, that just proceeds to show the progress bar, but instead, in this case, it shows this message: macOS cannot be installed on your computer. The path system installation packages osinstall.mpkg appears to be missing or damaged. And you just have a restart button and you just restart. Now, in my case, a couple clients got trapped in like a restart loop. Was that happening? I might have missed that in your story earlier, Jerry.
When you do restart, it doesn't actually come back to the login screen. It presents you with two disks on your screen and both of them say macOS install.
Interesting. Neither
one says Macintosh HD.
And that's even scarier. Wow.
Yeah.
So I can't remember exactly what fixed it in my case. In one case, we had to have a client drop off a laptop. There was another case where I gave them some guidance through email, I believe, and I can't remember what the outcome was. I mean, for all I know, they're still floundering. No relation to Rich Troughton. Other cases where I've had failed installations where it wants to boot by default to the installation partition, I guess, if I'm not misspeaking. We've had to either like reset in NVRAM or, you know, zap the PRAM, as I used to say, command option PR to basically reset the startup disk, I believe. I don't know if I think also a safe boot might sometimes be advised. But I just thought it was really interesting that this happened to multiple clients at the same time. At least one, if not two, said that they were 100% convinced they did not do anything to initiate it. It's just like they looked at their computer and this is what they saw. It's a little bit strange. Mm.
Yeah, we reached out to Jason Detbarn about this, the CEO of Adigy. He quotes, "It's speculation, but I've spent a lot of time on this. When you apply an update that requires a restart, it has to stage all the changes and then transactionally apply at restart. There is some bug in how they point to this on restart, and it doesn't seem to be 100% reproducible on the same Mac. It fails to do this across the board. And when you Google search it, you find a widespread issue with this. As a developer, I think they have a bug in some timing of their checks."
It certainly sounds like some kind of edge case scenario. And again, it's not exactly clear like what the difference is with these specific machines, but certainly a weird kind of issue. And, you know, our solution in the case where the client dropped off the machine to us was we ended up just wiping it and reformatting the drive and just clean installing, because they were actually trying to do that on their side. They had installed an OS, they had done some initial installed Office and just did some very basic setup, and then like walked away. And then a couple days later went to open up the machine and found it in this state. So that was one of the cases where they just said, you know, they were convinced that they had not done anything to like initiate this. So luckily, you know, it was a pretty easy fix in that case, but I'm not even sure what's the definitive solution. Yeah, certainly a weird one. I guess, I don't know if it's in fitting with this new segment, but hopefully we'll have some better conspiracies for you in the future.
I love your conspiracies or conspiracy theories.
Soon to be a major motion picture.
Right, exactly. So we have a little fun game for listeners. If you're listening to a past episode, you may have noticed. I know Jerry will remember this. Sam got bleeped. Did Sam, did you notice that? You got bleeped in a previous episode, a couple shows back. I don't know, man. You must have like let something slip. So here's the game. I just ruined my game too, because I was going to say guess the banned word, and we'll give you credit if you guess Sam's what word did he say. I don't even know if that was the word actually. So yeah, live listeners get an advantage here, but the listeners to the podcast feed won't know because it'll be bleeped again. So now it's getting meta. So what was bleeped this show, and also what was bleeped in a previous episode? What do they win? They're gonna get a mention on the show, and Sam will record your home answering machine outgoing voicemail message.
So this requires some research and some time, is what you're saying, Joe. Going back, listening to old shows, looking for Waldo, so to speak.
Right, exactly. Listen for that beep. What would Sam have said there? What word fits?
Hey, I got a quick side note to something else that happened to a client. I was on site at a client that I haven't seen in a while, and she had lost her personal iPhone. This is not something we managed. And unfortunately for her, she found out through the Apple Store that iCloud backup was off. And subsequently, obviously, so was Find My iPhone and all the services that would have made it kind of okay that she lost her phone. So I felt horrible for her. And she's like, "What can I do?" They told me there's nothing they can do. I said, "Well, you know, unfortunately, they're kind of right. But let me check one thing just in the off chance that we can retrieve data." So I plugged her iPhone into her work iMac. I also went into the mobile syncs folder under her library folder, and I found a mobile backups directory. And lo and behold, there was a local backup from July of the past year, which was huge because she had lost all her photos, all of her contacts were even local. They weren't in iCloud. It was a big mess. So I'm like, she's like, this is amazing. She was thrilled, excited, almost jumping out of her seat. I said, okay, what's the iCloud backup password? And she just sat there and stared. And I said, oh no, you don't have it, do you? So we spent like maybe 40 minutes just trying every iteration of every password possible and only to fail miserably. And we were never able to retrieve what seemed like so close. We had such hope to retrieve all of her data. And as far as I know, there's no way to ever get into an iCloud backup or an iTunes backup without that password. Am I correct, guys?
Probably you could do it with some kind of brute force, you know, that app that tries to figure it out. You know, there may be some tools out there for that, but that's come up once or twice. And the weird thing is, like, once encrypted, always encrypted. You know, have you guys encountered mm-hmm. that where like you back it up encrypted on one machine and maybe the client loses that or whatever, and then like they just start connecting it to a different machine, and when they go to back it up there, there's no way to like actually run a backup unless you know the encryption password also.
One company that leads the charge in running brute force programs, Elcomsoft, and we've mentioned them before on the show. They have a number of different priced products. They've got Elcomsoft PhoneBreaker. So it is indeed a program that you can run, and for a price, you can possibly decrypt and come up with the password that they used. So you may want to look into that.
I wonder if you could seed that. Like, could you seed that with passwords the client remembers, and it will try variants? And it's not something that's just like auto-generated. It's usually something they made up and totally forgot. And it could be like a four-letter. I don't think there's any limit, any lower limit on the number of characters either.
Right. And because it's a locally encrypted backup, you might have some success there. So, you know, if she wanted to throw enough money at it, they have a professional edition for $200. So it's very reasonable. They're the ones that frequently come into play for a lot of law enforcement, you know, cheap law enforcement.
So just a brief digression from our conversation. Just want to mention our sponsor, Watchman Monitoring. You can go to watchmanmonitoring.com/command control power to find out more. To bring it home for a minute, literally, my home machine is reporting errors. Of course, Watchman very intelligently notifies me that I've got some disk I/O errors, which is not a huge surprise because my home iMac, which we use mostly as a television set, has been really slow and kind of glitchy lately. The first sign of trouble was that iTunes would just start glitching out during playback. So now I'm only streaming through iTunes because my music library that's stored on my iMac is not accessible in a continuous manner. And sure enough, you know, I was wondering what was going on. And the next thing I know, I have this alert from Watchman saying, you've got disk I/O errors. And not to mention my uptime is 58 days, so I can't even take my own advice about restarting. But it's certainly great to, you know, I didn't even have to like look into it. I didn't have to run a scan. I didn't have to troubleshoot my own machine. I just got this alert from Watchman in my inbox immediately after wondering what's going on with my machine. Sure enough, Watchman says, this is what's going on with your machine. So it's just one of those things where, it paid for itself right there in saving me the time and effort to troubleshoot my own machine. Watchman Monitoring, it's a great piece of software. You've all probably heard about it by now, but for anybody who has not signed up, go immediately to watchmanmonitoring.com/command control power and check it out. For those uninitiated, Jerry, I think you wanted to talk a little bit about the background and what Watchman is and what it does for you.
Watchman Monitoring is a monitoring tool that you can not only install on your computer, but on all your client computers. So once you sign up, any client that you add to your Watchman account shows up in your control panel. Watchman will monitor server software. So it'll take a look at things like Daylight, Karyo server, Lightspeed server. It'll make sure that those servers are working properly and backing up. It'll make sure that your Time Machine backups are working properly. It integrates seamlessly with products like Backblaze, CrashPlan, Carbon Copy Cloner. It will monitor I/O errors on disk drives, like Joe had mentioned. It'll take a look at RAID systems. It monitors network system performance, detects malware, and also can give you great reports on clients that you have on your network. So if your client is looking for inventory on all his machines and they want serial numbers and specs, Watchman can deliver that to you as well. It's invaluable, and we don't know how we run our businesses without it.
Yeah, before Watchman, I just remember having to like somehow corral all these disparate email alerts from all this various software. You know, Carbon Copy Cloner is telling me that a backup failed, and Cario is telling me that a license expired, and you know, and you just have to like figure out how to manage all that stuff. With Watchmen, you just have one portal, you have one place where you can go in and you can say, I don't want to know about this again for 30 days. Don't bother me again for a little while on this issue. Or you can go through and you can just get a list, a recap of all of these little issues, either by client or by machine or whatever the case may be. So it's just such a great way to have a centralized dashboard where you can see just what's going on with all of your monitored systems. And so it's just a fantastic piece of software. Highly recommended. WatchmenMonitoring.com/Command Control Power. Thanks again to Watchman Monitoring for sponsoring Command Control Power.
Yeah, I have some quick follow-up on a Synology thing, and this calls back to the episode with Weldon Dodd from a few weeks ago, but we were talking about different Synology things and discussing some options. And one of the things that was brought up was the ability to quickly rebuild the RAID if you had to replace a drive. And I actually had to encounter that the other day. We received a Synology alert that drive in bay one was failing. We went over and it was failing some tests. So we immediately ordered a new WD Red to be replaced in that device, scheduled some time with the client. I went into the office. We basically had everyone unmount just to be safe. We popped out the drive in bay one, quickly put in the new one. And then at that point, the Synology report said it's in a degraded state. We go into the volume manager and we run the rebuild. And of course, that process can take some time, but you can use the box while it's happening, which is obviously a big thing. And we just told them to expect some speed degradation during the day as this was going to happen. And it was lickety-split, the easiest thing by far that I've done, and really proved to them why having a Synology was so key to their solution. Because we had recently, well, actually about a year ago, replaced their Mac Mini server with a Promise RAID with this solution. And it was just a really simple process to go through. So I wanted to follow up with that because that was a direct question that Weldon and I were talking about back then.
So I'm always excited to share stuff with you guys. And like I say, I'm largely ignored when I text you about all these wonderful things I find, but I still feel the need to share to our listeners. So one of the things I've been doing successfully is running with the Apple Watch. I've got an Apple Watch 2, the Nike edition, and I got a pretty good buy on that. Best Buy ran a sale a couple months ago before the holidays, and it was heavily discounted, and so I let go of my first-gen Apple Watch. And it's been going great, and I've been going through these apps that will allow you to download a podcast to the Apple Watch, because that's always been my dream, is to not have the phone with me. And since I've got this Apple II watch, I've successfully been able to do that. And I've been trying, like I said, a number of different apps that will allow you to download a podcast. And most of them are pretty bad and pretty unsuccessful up until now. So for 99 cents, you can get this iOS app called Outcast. Outcast will successfully and very, very quickly download a podcast to your Apple Watch. And you can, you know, certainly just listen to it as you're walking down the street or doing your chores around the house, or if you're running, it'll play very nicely and at the same time, like, track your progress with the Nike Watch. So the way this is done is you actually download the podcast on the Apple Watch. So if you're looking for a specific show, you need to do the search with the app on the Apple Watch. And that works pretty well. And then when you want to download the actual show to the Apple Watch, if you leave Bluetooth on, it'll communicate with the phone and it'll just go in little tiny drips, and it'll take you forever to get a 40 megabyte show. But if you successfully just put your Apple phone into airplane mode, your Apple Watch is no longer communicating with your phone, and your Apple Watch will default to the local Wi-Fi. So if it's on your local Wi-Fi, it'll have that password, and magically, this podcast will just fly onto your Apple Watch using the application Outcast. So two enthusiastic thumbs up for that. And I'm glad I really found a solution, because that was one of the worst things. Some of these apps that are out there, they will transfer the data, but it goes over Bluetooth and it's untenably long and slow.
It's so weird that it uses Bluetooth so much. And also just how slow the watch is. Like when you do things like computery with it, like an update, it like reminds you that it's so limited in speed, and it's just a magic that it actually works when you're just interacting with it normally. you know, especially with the latest OS and everything. But that's a really interesting tip. So you have to put your phone in airplane mode so the watch is just now untethered, therefore falling back to just using its own built-in Wi-Fi.
Exactly. And then it's just incredible how fast the podcast will download onto the Apple Watch. So it's been a real win for me. And I just love it. I mean, I just think that's magic. And being able to even answer the occasional phone call on the Apple Watch is very magical as well. So that's been very, very cool.
I find it, in all fair honesty, interesting just on the running part that you can, I need something to motivate me that you can listen to a podcast while running. Like that doesn't do it for me as in terms of motivation. You don't need any kind of like, I don't know, pumping up music to get you going, Jerry.
Have you seen me run, Sam?
Apparently not.
I think you're a lot more goal motivated. I mean, I certainly look at what my mile pace is. You do a lot more endurance running and a lot more training for much longer stints. My usual loop is about a 5K, you know, 3.8, just right around there. And for me, I just like to bang it out for recreational purposes. I don't necessarily need the Rocky music. Gonna fly now in my ears. Because that's what you listen to, right, Sam?
Not Rocky music, no.
You can always go to 2X speed, Jerry, if you need some real, like, you know, fast rate podcast music to pump you up.
I'm able to listen to podcasts at usually 1.5X, and maybe that makes me run faster. I don't know. Maybe there's my motivation.
There you go.
The other cool things that I found is something that I've been using for a while, and it's from a company called PilotMoon.com, and it's called PopClip. And PopClip, anytime you select text to copy, usually invoked with like a right click, PopClip will give you this wherever you are on the Mac OS, this contextual menu, but it's a horizontal contextual menu versus a typical Apple one that shows up vertically. And you can put all kinds of different extensions into PopClip. So one of the things that you could do is you could make it, you could use a bit.ly URL shortener. So you highlight a piece of text, PopClip shows its little contextual horizontal menu, and you select your bit.ly icon and it shortens your URL. You can make an Amazon affiliate link. There's all different add-ons that you can add and customize to PopClip, and it's absolutely wonderful. And most recently, they added a little connector to those great folks that make Fantastical, and that's FlexBits. So if you go to flexbits.com, they have a new Mac app called CardHop. It's just what we need, another contact program to run the Mac. But this PopClip, the way it'll work is, let's say somebody, you know, a new client reaches out to you and you want to add this new client to your contact register. And usually the data detectors sometimes don't always work properly when you're adding it to the Apple Contacts app. So you've got an email, you right click, the data detector sees it. All you need to do is, you know, you get a brand new address in your email, you highlight it, PopClip pops open, and you press the icon that represents CardHop, and magically CardHop is so smart that it'll just completely populate correctly all the information into a new contact card for this particular person that you just generated. So real nice synergy with those two apps together. So PopClip and CardHop.
Nice. Well, speaking of PopClip, I have a pop quiz for you guys. Everyone's favorite. Well, so this is kind of a straightforward one that came up recently. We had been talking about, like Sam, you mentioned this great tip. It's a great pro tip if anybody missed this, of scheduling the startup. You know, so you can go into Energy Saver and you can schedule a startup or wake at a certain time. In your case, you were connecting to the guest Wi-Fi and you were remote and you were afraid if like you select the guest Wi-Fi and connect to it and it doesn't work, you know, now you're disconnected and you have no way of reconnecting to that machine remotely. So what you did, this was brilliant, was connect to the guest Wi-Fi, but don't save the SSID or password. Right before you do that, you schedule a startup. Or I guess schedule a restart, right? For like
a
2 minutes later.
Right.
Yeah. So that was a really neat idea because it would restart and then it would not be connected to the guest network and therefore would reconnect to its own, you know, preferred network. And you'd be back in whether or not the guest, you know, if the guest Wi-Fi connected, I guess you could just cancel the restart, right? If you're still connected. So really cool idea. And I use the same technique in a different way where we had an external drive that I think was bus powered that was connected to a machine and was just unmounted, you know, would not show up on the USB bus. And so I wanted to basically shut down and then start back up because if shut down would remove power from the USB bus, causing the drive to unmount. So we talked about, you know, shutting down and then booting up versus doing a restart. And you can also schedule that. So you schedule the startup to take place, you know, 2 minutes from now, and then you just go ahead and shut the machine down. And you hope you got the timing right, and you hope it doesn't have any updates queued up or, you know, something that's going to change the timing any. But basically, the end result is it shuts down, waits a minute or two, and then it starts back up from a cold start. So I wanted to mention something I had learned a ways back, thanks to some Watchman monitoring alerts. These alerts were reporting the memory installed has changed from 7 gigabytes to 5 gigabytes. This was an old Mac Pro tower. And then I'd get another Watchman alert, like a couple weeks later, the memory installed has changed from 5 gigabytes to 7 gigabytes. And I'm like, what is causing this machine to think it has different amounts of memory? And I realized that this was, the difference was, and I might've just answered my own pop quiz, a cold boot versus a restart. So Does that give anybody enough information to dive in with an explanation there?
It does a full post at startup. Is that where you're going?
Exactly. That's what I was looking for.
Yes. Ding, what ding, do I ding. Win? What do I win?
You can leave your own outgoing voicemail on my answering machine.
You've got to come up with new prizes, man. That's right. It's already been used.
That's right. Well, yeah. So that's the answer. A post, a power on self-test. It only happens on a cold boot. It does not happen on a restart. So if you have client machines that only ever get restarted, it's actually not doing its built-in little post, you know, power on self-test, which say it does a memory test. It's certainly not doing an extensive one, but it does do kind of a general, I don't know, sanity check of some sort on the memory. And it doesn't do that when it just restarts. So I thought that was kind of an interesting data point. Is there any other, do we know what else a post does exactly?
I forget all the details, but it checks some basic hardware components to make sure that they're operational. I forget every part that it checks, to be honest with you, but...
Fair enough. So it's something, it is different from a restart, which I just thought, you know, it never occurred to me that those two things were different, you know, and then I sort of like had to remind myself of that. So
it's late in the day. I can't think anymore.
And just for clarity's sake, Joe, when it was reporting these differentials in the memory size, what was the memory was failing from time to time?
Exactly. Good question. Yes. So I think the memory just had a marginal failure. And so this machine ended up being one that, you know, sort of fell out of use and just sat there, you know, never got migrated to a new machine, never got officially decommissioned. The user just kind of stopped using it. And so we never actually addressed this, but basically my theory, it was, you know, there's probably one or two modules in there, probably one pair of 1 gigabyte modules, one of which is having a marginal failure. So it would do the post and sometimes it would be like, yeah, no, the memory's fine. And other times it would realize there's some kind of problem. And so it would just be random. It's 5 gigs, it's 7 gigs.
I'm realizing on this show that I don't have a thing. Like, you have your conspiracy corner, and Jerry seems to have his app corner. He always has these great app recommendations that he gets excited about. I don't have a thing. I got to come up with a thing.
Jerry, still just leaving you wide open to just, you know, Sam wants to know what is his thing. You're going to, you know,
Sam's thing is he's got a fashion corner.
Oh, that's true.
Right, he's got the flak jacket and the putty jacket and the hat. So I think he's more of a fashion guy.
The Jamf jumpsuit.
Fair enough. Sam's fashion corner. I like it.
Right, there you go. I'd like to thank our patrons, our very loyal patrons and supporters. We really, really appreciate your support. Many of you go unmentioned week after week, but every month we like to thank our patrons of a certain level who pledge to support the show. And it really is a vote of confidence in us doing the show. And it really just shows your support. And so we really, really appreciate it. To count yourself among these esteemed colleagues, you can find out more at commandcontrolpower.com and click on support. And we'd like to thank Ryan Gowdy of corecompetent.com, JD Strong of Strong Solutions, SpokaneMac.com, Daniel Escobar of Proactex, that's Proactex.com, Nate Sinal of 813core.com, Steve Sorbo, MacSOS.biz, Eric Grau of Chibitech.com, Adam Angst of Tidbits Content Network, Tidbits.com, Stacy Conaway of Syncotech.com, Andy Espo of CallAndy.com, Tom Poles of BoxIT.tech, Jerome Potters of MacPot.nl, Will O'Neill of 4MacSolutions.com, Adam Rice of AdamRice.org, Matthew Waples of Waples.net, Richard Wingfield of EnvisionDesign.net, Michael Thompson of Origin84.com, Brian Mueller of Jamf.com, Tom Bridge of Technolutionary.com, Tim Nyberg of the Mac Guys Plus, themacguys.com, Weldon Dodd of rewindtech.com, Dennis Nolan, Cirrus Partners, gocirrus.com, and Kevin Ginger of kginger.com. Thank you all very much for your support. So to close out the show, I have a new segment. I'd like to introduce one more of this show.
Oh, come on.
The show of new segments. The topic is how to think like a client. So one example I have for this is, here's a scenario. You have a client with a Mac. The Time Machine backups aren't running. So you get the Watchman alert, hasn't backed up in X number of days, and you're wondering what's going on. And you connect, and it's working fine. It's backing up to a time capsule, and you just, you know, you say backup now. It's connected, it's happy, there's no problem. So you don't have to actually fix anything, but it is your job as a consultant to sort of figure out, what are these warnings coming from? Have you guys ever been in this situation?
Yes. Is it a laptop?
Yeah, it's a laptop, exactly.
Oh man, I'm good tonight.
You're on fire, Sam. All right, what's the explanation?
Well, I mean, if it's not connected to the network, or if they take that laptop off site, it's not connecting to the time capsule to back up to. So you got the alert.
True. Okay. There's another scenario, and this is the one that I've encountered enough times to want to talk about this. So basically, the default setting is not to back up while on battery power. So what happens is, I've found, clients treat laptops like iPhones, you know, or iPads, right? You don't use it. You don't plug it in. You don't charge it.
Unless you have a 2016 MacBook Pro like I do.
Right. You really need to at that point. Yeah, exactly. Well, most clients treat it like, you know, it's just this like thing that you plug in to charge once in a while, and then you just like unplug it and go do something with it. You know, you use it in the other room or whatever. They just never, I mean, so this is why I call this how to think like a client. Clients don't realize that you have to plug it into power and then leave it open and let the backup run. Like, so basically the scenario is, it's either open and being used sort of in a different room maybe, or just not plugged into anything. And then they close it and they plug it in and charge it. And, you know, then it's not being used. It's plugged in. Maybe PowerNap is not turned on, or it's an older machine that doesn't support PowerNap. So it's not going to back up when it's sleeping. And it's of course sleeping when the lid is closed. So basically you have these like opposing scenarios. It's either like open and being used, but not plugged into battery to power. It's running off the battery, or it's plugged in and charging, but sleeping.
Technically, the laptop, if it's plugged in and lid closed, it should or could do a dark wake where it does Time Machine backups during that time.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. I said power nap, but yeah, dark wake. Right. Right. But maybe that setting is turned off, or it's just an older machine that doesn't, you know, support dark wake. I think dark wake is a hardware enabled feature, right? I mean, it came out in software, but it's like only supporting Macs that are of a certain recent age, right?
Like SSDs of a certain year. I can't remember the exact year, but you're right. Mm-hmm. It was hardware dependent.
Right. And so, you know, the idea is like, you have to think like a client. Like, they just would never think about that. And every time this has come up where something's not backing up and I connect and I just instruct them, there's been a few cases in recent, you know, weeks where I just like explain to them that this is the way it works. And they're like, oh, now that I know that, I'll just do that. Like, I'll just basically leave it plugged in and use it for a while and make sure my backup runs.
Once you explain it to them, then they're well aware, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not like a complicated thing to understand. It's not something that's like super technical. It's just not the way a client would think. They just think of these things as like all equivalent. You know, it's just interesting to me because I think of a Mac as like a distinctly different thing. You know, you have to treat it differently. Like, you plug it in when you're using it. You plug it in as much as possible because we don't expect long battery life from these things. You know, whereas with an iPhone, like, I don't use it while plugged in, you know, 99% of the time. They don't think of it that way. Clients are sort of just, you know, they're like normal people. They think that, you know, you plug it in at night and then you use it during the day and you don't have it plugged in. So I just thought that was an interesting way to think about this stuff, how to think like a client, how to think like a normal person.
Speaking of thinking like a client, I've got a good one for you. This happened to me this past week. We have a client, and she's an attorney, and she works out of her home, and she's got an iMac and she's got a portable. And she said, something's going on with my portable. Every single thing I try to open or download ends up being, and we'll just say the file was called mydocument.zip. So she's saying, like, everything I'm downloading, everything's got the same name. I don't understand. It's like crazy. So we send her a link to do the TeamViewer. She clicks on it. It downloads. She goes, yeah, I'm going to the downloads folder. And oh, it opens up as mydocument.zip. Really? This is happening? And so we couldn't get TeamViewer going. And I'm like, okay, all right, I'm going to have to come by. So she's just a few miles out of the way. So schedule a time, arrive on site. She opens up the laptop. I start looking at it. There's the document. And I see that there's this one document that's been downloaded a number of times in the downloads folder called mydocument.zip. And I said, well, show me what you're doing. Here's TeamViewer. Here it is here in your downloads folder. And so she was clicking on the doc, and she was clicking on what she thought was her downloads folder. Well, somehow, inadvertently, she had dragged mydocuments.zip into her doc where her downloads folder was. And her downloads folder was never shown as a folder. It was shown always as a stack.
Right.
You know how you can change how that viewed. So she just thought she was looking at her downloads folder. And so she double-clicked the mydocuments.zip. Another unzipping of that document would arrive on her desktop or, you know, somewhere. And she thought everything that she was downloading was landing there, and it was called mydocuments.zip.
Oh, that's rough. And you had to go all the way over there.
Yeah. Right. And so I said, no. I said, this is that document is actually just sitting in your doc. It's an alias to where it is in the downloads folder. We'll just drag it out of the doc. And here, let me put your downloads folder back. And I moved it back into the doc. And I said, see, there are all your downloads. This isn't happening. Everything's good.
That is rough that you had to go all the way there for that. I've totally been in that situation. You know, remote can only go so far if they can't download something. You know, and that's, yeah, it's a great example of how to think like a client. Can you download something and open it? Like, that's, you know, it's like.
Sometimes you're doing remote support and you spend a half hour just downloading and starting TeamViewer.
Right. Oh, man. I think the amount of, like, the percentage of my life spent doing that is, I don't want to know. You know, I've spent like 45 minutes. I'm like, how far away is this client? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And you know the client has downloaded TeamViewer at least 17 times.
Oh, the worst is when they list them for you and they're like, TeamViewer QS, QS2, QS3. I'm like, just pick one. I don't
just
care.
Just stop talking. Yeah,
right. You've downloaded this from the internet. Right, exactly. Open it up.
I'm like, what, you know, you just want to be like, what do you think I want you to do? Do I, you know, like, well, the whole point is we're trying to open it. Like, what are you asking me right now? Oh, man. That's when you just like.
I've got tears in my eyes. That's so true. That's oh, so my God. True. And you only know this until you've lived through it, you know? Oh, my gosh.
Oh, man. It's good to vent about this, though. I'm glad it's not just me.
Thanks again to Watchman Monitoring for sponsoring this episode of Command Control Power. Go to watchmanmonitoring.com/CCP, and you could start your 30-day free trial.